It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine a potential new line of defense against sexually transmitted infections, a dose of the antibiotic doxycycline taken soon after sex to lower the risk of contracting common STIs like chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Shira Heisler is medical director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic and an assistant professor in Wayne State University's Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Heisler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us about this antibiotic. What is doxycycline?
So doxycycline is part of the class of antibiotics that we use for a lot of different infections. And it is currently, it's part of the guidelines for an alternative treatment for syphilis. Currently, we're in a national shortage of bicillin, and it's also used for treatment of chlamydia. So that's how it's traditionally used in the STI world. And now there's about three different studies that have suggested that if you use a dose of 200 milligrams one time, ideally within 24 hours after having sex, only within 72 hours, it can reduce syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea significantly.
It seems like this antibiotic, which apparently has been around for a long time, it seems quite versatile. Like, it's useful in a number of medical areas or situations. Do you find that that is the case?
Yeah, I mean, doxycycline, it's used for soft tissue infections. Yes, it is it has a broad spectrum of coverage. So yes, it is used in a lot of different avenues, which is the concern of using doxy-PEP, is that there's going to be a concern is that it's going to increase resistance. And then for other infections, including STIs, will it still work? That's kind of the concern in doxy-PEP.
So you mentioned these studies. How effective is a small dose of doxycycline? Also, as you mentioned, doxy-PEP called that as well, for preventing STIs.
Yeah, so I first want to be clear. All these studies were specifically in men having sex with men and transgender women. And that is because they disproportionately account for all STIs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. So the goal was to do it in this specific narrow group because they're holding the highest burden. In terms of what we saw, so in 2018, there was a study, the IPERGATE trial. This was actually for HIV PrEP, but there was a sub-study, and that showed decrease of chlamydia by 70% and syphilis by 73%. Then in 2021, which was the main trial of truly doxy-PEP, trying this out, this showed in HIV negative folks a decrease of chlamydia and syphilis by 87%.
Wow.
In HIV positive folks, 75%, and a decrease in gonorrhea, 55%. Which was actually quite surprising. We did not, doxycycline has known resistance to gonorrhea. It was quite surprising that it had any effect. And then another study, a French study called DoxyVac, showed very similar results that showed decrease in chlamydia by 88%, decrease in syphilis by 87%, and decrease in gonorrhea by 51%. So these are pretty amazing results.
Dr. Shira Heisler with us, medical director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic, as we talk about the prevention of sexually transmitted infections and a focus right now with researchers on doxy-PEP or doxycycline, the antibiotic. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned the study looking specifically at gay men, the transgender community. As what I understand from the trials, though, women are not having the same effect with the antibiotics. What do you see there?
So there was one trial. There's still ongoing trials. There was one trial that was done in a country in Africa, and it was amongst women who were on PrEP. And it didn't show these results. Why? We're not sure. Was it adherence? Is it that the cervical tissue is very different than anal and urethral tissue, right? And how maybe 72 hours is just too long for it to protect the cervical tissue. Maybe 24 hours would work. Maybe it's adherence. We don't know. There are now more trials going on. But as of now, there isn't any data to suggest that it does work in cisgender women.
And you, I understand, have been prescribing DoxyPep at your clinic for the past 7 months. Who are you typically recommending receiving the antibiotic?
So this is a great question. And kind of right now we're waiting on CDC guidelines to come out. And so different clinics across the country are doing it slightly differently. What I do is any patient, a man who has sex with men or transgender women, if they have had any STI within the past 2 years, or they're just considered truly at higher risk, so they're engaging in chem sex or group sex or multiple partners, those are people that we are recommending it to. And what's really kind of exciting is that the uptake is really, really high. People are really excited about it, which is a really encouraging thing that this could actually be an intervention that could really work and affect the actual population that this is disproportionately affecting.
I think it's also important to note how serious these sexually transmitted infections can become if left untreated. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So syphilis. So I think the thing that is really important to understand right now is that we are in an epidemic of STIs. Our numbers of syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea are all significantly on the rise. And in particular in syphilis, there is significant negative sequelae that could happen, right? It could enter the central nervous system. You can have meningitis. You can have ocular syphilis affecting the eyes, leading to permanent blindness. You can have otic syphilis leading to permanent hearing loss. There is true, and we are seeing increased cases of these really severe negative outcomes. And this would be a way, again, to curb it.
You mentioned the CDC and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They recently had a comment period on proposed mm-hmm. guidelines for the use of DoxyPep. And I'm just wondering, what is the federal public health role here in this emerging avenue, if you will, for preventing the infection spread?
Great question. I feel really comfortable to prescribe DoxyPep, but I am deep in the STI world. If we get CDC guidelines, people on the front lines in primary care would feel more comfortable and have more guidance on how to do it. And the more people that we get on it, we'll see the greater effect. And so I think that this would allow and give a huge range of providers way more comfort and guidance on how to do it and to feel comfortable doing it.
Do you think that the CDC is moving quickly on DoxyPep?
I think, you know, that's a good question. I feel they're in a kind of maybe tougher boat, right? Like everyone looks to their guidelines. I would like to see them out. You know, we've now had this data around February. So I really hope that this is coming out soon. They did give this primary guidelines that, you know, within the past 2 months or so for everyone to comment on. And now hopefully we'll see it coming out soon.
Dr. Shira Heisler is medical director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic, as we learn about the antibiotic doxycycline being used to try to prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a growing body of research around the antibiotic doxycycline and its potential to lower the risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases with a preventative treatment under study. It's called DoxyPep. Call in with a question or share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Shira Heisler with us, medical director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic. Dr. Heisler, in particular with syphilis in Wisconsin, cases of syphilis rose 19% between 2021 and 2022. What segments of the population are suffering the most from the spread of syphilis?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm more familiar with what's going on in Michigan, but I would imagine that it is mirrored in other places. So what we see is consistently, unfortunately, men who have sex with men disproportionately account for cases of syphilis. And I want to be extra clear here. In syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea, there is no pathologic, physiologic, biological reason why that is. It is because they share the same sexual networks. This is a disparity that we can address and change. In Michigan in particular, even though men having sex with men disproportionately account for the total cases, the rise in heterosexual men and women having sex with men, the rate has gone up significantly. And we have seen there is, as CDC came out within the past couple weeks, about how congenital syphilis is a national crisis. In the state of Michigan in 2021, we had around 40 some cases of congenital syphilis, three were stillborns, so which is a totally preventable thing. So we clearly have a problem that is affecting all different groups. It isn't just gay men, but they do hold the highest burden of cases.
What is the stigma like now with having an STI?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I also work doing HIV work, and I was at an STI conference, and, you know, someone said, and I maybe would agree, that maybe the stigma is even higher in STIs, unfortunately. Yes, I think that that's part of our work, is to reduce stigma. And I will say, in my HIV work, in my STI work, my biggest thing that I'm fighting is stigma, is internalized homophobia. And I think that, you know, so many people, I've had recently a lot of new HIV diagnoses in the heterosexual population, men and women, and so many of them are like, but I'm not gay, but I'm not gay. And it's like the understanding that this is, HIV doesn't care if you're Black, if you're white, if you're gay, if you're straight. It can penetrate in different locations easier. But I would say that I think the biggest work of all of the people involved in this is decreasing the stigma. And that is a powerful fight that we need to do, and it's very difficult.
When you take the case of antibiotics in the fight against the spread of sexually transmitted infections, I mean, would people who do contract an STI eventually need an antibiotic to get on an antibiotic anyway for treatment?
Yes. So you definitely kind of, if you're on DoxyPep, that's a good question. So part of the protocol is, if you are taking DoxyPep and you get an STI, you're positive for it because you should get testing every 3 months, you treat as per CDC guidelines. So you stop the DoxyPep. You shouldn't be having sex while you have an active infection. You take the prescribed course of the regular treatment and then can go back on it.
Okay. How concerned are clinicians that, you know, regularly use DoxyPep that it could lead to antibiotic resistance for particular patients?
There is very high concern for resistance, and it is legitimate concern. Antibiotic resistance is a big problem. We see with gonorrhea, we already had a few cases in Massachusetts of it being resistant to ceftriaxone. And so this could increase resistance 100%. However, when I kind of get that question in relating to DoxyPep, My feeling is, as you said earlier on, we're using doxycycline for many different things. And so now we have a known intervention that works with amazing data, decreasing chlamydia and syphilis by 87, 88% and gonorrhea by 50%. So when now that we have an intervention that specifically targets men who have sex with men, now we're going to say, well, resistance a problem and we're not going to offer it. That to me seems like this is what stigma looks like.
Mm.
And so I would really caution us to be like, yes, we need to acknowledge resistance is a problem. But we're still using the medication with all this other stuff. So why don't we use it here? And it could be a temporary solution, right? The whole thing is to curb STIs in this moment because they're so out of control.
What caused me pause when I read about one of the trials was stopped early because it was the results were so promising. It was so the control group could also have the antibiotic and start receiving it. I mean, that to me was that struck me by surprise that you would stop the trial and actually give the antibiotic as well to the control group not receiving it.
Yeah, because there's an ethical thing. The same thing happened with cabotegravir for PrEP and now an injectable form of prevention for HIV. And there's the ethical thing is we now see, I mean, if this is reducing chlamydia in syphilis by in the 80 percentiles, it would really be an ethical disservice to not offer this to everyone, which is really why we're wanting the CDC to push the CDC to get out guidelines so people feel comfortable to do this. This is just as all these other interventions, pre or post prophylaxis, the only way they work is if we take them. And so we need more people, more providers to be prescribing it.
Dr. Shira Heisler with us, medical director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic, as we talk about the prevention of sexually transmitted infections, new research on DoxyPep. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Dr. Heisler, how does DoxyPep as a treatment compare to the medication PrEP for preventing HIV infection?
It is very different.
Okay.
So first of all, HIV is a virus. The DoxyPep is an antibiotic treating bacteria. So that's different. And also for HIV PrEP, we're using HIV, partial HIV medication for PrEP or post-exposure prophylaxis. And here in DoxyPep, we're using an antibiotic that's used for a lot of other different things. Now, I do also want to be clear in, let's say, for chlamydia treatment or even syphilis treatment, because now we're giving doxycycline because we're trying to preserve our bicillin for pregnant women because we're in a national shortage. We are giving these antibiotics as treatment, which is a way longer course. So if we could now give this 200 milligram dose one time and prevent these longer courses of treatment, we could actually possibly be using the antibiotic less.
So this year's UC San Francisco study involving patients, as you mentioned, taking 200 milligrams of doxycycline within 3 days of having sex without condoms. If this treatment does become widely used and available, how could that affect strategies to reduce infections? How accessible could it be?
Great question. Well, first of all, doxycycline is very cheap. So that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how we do it in making it accessible is, so first of all, I work at a public health STD clinic that's fully funded by the state health department. So we get medications for treatment of all STIs. They now give all clinics in the state who ask for it. We now have bottles for people who don't have insurance to give them DoxyPep. So one of the things that I do want it, which I didn't mention earlier, is, as I said, it disproportionately affects men having sex with men. It disproportionately affects Black men who have sex with men and transgender women. And so one of the things is I'm hoping, as you know, I live and work in Detroit, which is overwhelmingly Black, is to get it to this population. I do know it's very common. Many white gay men know all about DoxyPep. And then we see in the Black community, it's not really well known yet, and people don't know about it. So the key is spreading education, getting the CDC to come out with guidelines so we have something on a national scale to say, look, all these experts are agreeing with this, and to get it to the greater population, in particular, Black men having sex with men.
Dr. Heisler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Shira Heisler, Medical Director of the Detroit Public Health STD Clinic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the rise of direct admissions programs in Wisconsin and how they could affect the makeup of college campuses. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about remembering our loved ones.
When someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness, how do we choose to preserve the memory of that person? Radio producer Alexandra Salmon and her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, have always been close. When Chris was recently diagnosed with terminal cancer, Alexandra started recording some of their conversations. And on a perfect fall day, the two of them talked about Chris's lifelong connection to Wisconsin and what she hopes to leave behind.
I think I'm experiencing some of the sounds in my mind because they're sounds of little kids laughing and having fun. And that's, if I had had a woods like this near me, I would have been in it.
That's my mother-in-law, Chris Thomas. We're in the woods near her house in Madison, where she's thinking about putting her memorial bench. This little piece of wildness reminds her of another park she loved as a child.
It wasn't right at our near our house, but it was down at Westmoreland Park. And once I was old enough to have my freedom to go down there, it was really fun. I mean, we played in the woods like this. It was a little deeper and darker than this one, but kids just fantasize. They love having places like this to come to. And we hear kids down here giggling and, you know, playing, and it's really nice.
Chris is such a practical person, and she's always thought about putting other people first. The way she's approaching this memorial bench is no different. Can you just talk a little bit about this bench idea?
Well, it's certainly a copycatted idea all over the place. I mean, lots of people have benches, and I never thought of myself as somebody that wanted to mark my spot or be so impressive that I had a bench. I don't know why I thought about it, except that I like the fact that there are places for people to sit who, you know, people who might not walk this trail otherwise, if they knew there was a bench every so often, they might walk it more. And I think that's a good goal, to have something out here that people can actually utilize. So it's my little contribution to getting people out walking, you know, especially people that wouldn't do it otherwise.
Oh, what's this? Walnut?
Maybe.
Yeah, it's hollow.
Maybe from where we're standing, we look at what we're seeing. If I stand at a diagonal, I see that big tree, and that is the only really big tree right in there. And you know what? If we find another spot, fine, you know. But I kind of like this spot.
Yeah.
It feels good. Yeah, I think along this trail, and the other trail would get used. But it'd just be sitting out along a trail, and this is so pretty in here.
Yeah.
So special. Yeah.
Well, and really, I do like those hidden benches.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like a surprise. You
mm-hmm.
come upon it, and then you think about who was this person.
Yeah. One winter when I walked in the Arboretum a lot, I found a chrysalis or something hanging from a thread. And I watched that thing all winter, and then one day it was gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
I come
That was audio producer Alexandra Salmon talking with her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, about her memorial bench. Big thanks to Meeker and Maiden for letting us use their version of the song, Hills of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Universities of Wisconsin system is set to roll out a direct admissions program next year. We learn how this policy of proactively admitting high school seniors could affect the student body on system campuses. Be part of the discussion about college admissions. Call in with a question. Share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Taylor, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So starting next summer, most of the state's public universities plan to start sending these letters to high schoolers that proactively admit students rather than waiting for them to apply. Why are campuses trying this new approach to admissions?
Yeah, so that's right. And I think direct admissions kind of asks this fundamental question about why are we requiring students to apply to college, to many colleges in the first place? And the that feels kind of radical, but the reality is that about a third of all students attend two-year or open access institutions like community colleges. And more than 50% of additional students attend a four-year college or university that admits more than 75% of people who apply. So the vast majority of people in the United States, if they're attending college, they're attending college at a minimally selective or open access institution. And so that means... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so it sounds like let's remove a barrier that shouldn't be there anyway when we look at admissions numbers.
That's exactly right. So if we do apply to these colleges, they're looking at maybe our GPA, maybe our course grades, maybe our ACT or SAT score. But we're those pieces of data already live in our K-12 school system, at our high schools. And so the idea is basically saying, if we only need these couple of pieces of information to make a decision, if we're actually making a decision at all, why don't we just get the data from where it already lives rather than asking students to jump all of these hoops of writing an essay, submitting a resume, getting a high schooler to send a transcript and things like that.
So giving finding the data where it lives, I wonder how will universities decide which students can skip the application process and directly enroll?
Yeah, so the way that it works in most states is that every student gets some post-secondary opportunity. So every student in the state who, for instance, would opt in to say, yes, I want to participate in this program, they would get some post-secondary option. For students who then are higher achieving, may have higher GPAs or a better kind of suite of course grades, you can kind of think of a tiered system where as they go up on those tiers of performance, they would then get into more institutions or even maybe more selective institutions. And so the University of Wisconsin plan to use students' high school GPAs to determine, you know, everybody's going to get into a specific set of institutions, and those with higher GPAs are going to get into maybe slightly more selective or more institutions here.
I wonder about the technology and automation behind policies like this. I mean, computer algorithms, they are under scrutiny across the country over their potential to reflect human stereotypes and bias. Do you see concerns with how campuses could design these programs and design algorithms for proactively admitting students?
Sure. I think we should be concerned anytime there's potentially a black box that's making kind of really important life decisions. But I would say two things to that. One, Direct admissions policies, and especially the one that's designed in Wisconsin, are very transparent. There is no kind of predictive analytics here. There is no mining of different types of student data. It's just what's your GPA? Here's the threshold. And so students and families and counselors and principals can easily know, here's my student's GPA. This is obviously the institution that they're going to get into. And when they receive these communications, it should be spelled out for them as well. So you know exactly what the score was that was used and exactly where that fell kind of on the continuum into which of those places. I would also say, in regards to kind of AI, algorithmic bias and things, I do think it's right that we should be, I think, cautious of employing these kind of in a very hot, widespread way. But what's also important is for us to not be fearful of innovating in this way because we have such wide geographic inequality, socioeconomic inequality, racial inequality, and who even goes to college. And so if there is a way of automating it, of finding folks who may not have thought they were college material, then that benefit definitely outweighs the cost to me.
Along those lines, you've worked with, I understand, Common App, the nonprofit online portal that is targeting first-generation college students. What is Common App's approach to direct admissions offers?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we've done some work with the Common App and also with many states across the US. But basically, what the Common App is able to do is to say millions, 1.2, 1.3 million students come to the Common App every year, and they provide lots of important information to that platform, like their GPA, like their SAT or ACT score. And so what the Common App is then able to do is say, hey, Kate, there's an institution really close by that might be a good fit for you that's willing to directly admit you without you having to fill out, the full Common App or submit letters of rec or jump through all of these hoops that that institution has said are really unnecessary for you. So basically, they're able to mine their entire population of students for those who opt in to getting communications from them and things like that to kind of proactively push post-secondary opportunities to those folks.
Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison, researching the rise of direct admissions in Wisconsin, around the country, automatically enrolling prospective college students. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the rise of direct admissions at colleges and universities as the Universities of Wisconsin system launches a program next summer in the race to attract eligible high school students amid enrollment declines at some campuses. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts on admissions. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Taylor, taking stock here, 10 campuses among the UW system are participating in the direct admissions program. The exceptions, UW-Madison, UW-La Crosse, and UW-Eau Claire. Why might campuses opt out of participating in a program like this?
Sure. Well, I think first, this new approach to kind of reimagining the college admissions process can feel rather kind of explosive or radical to a lot of folks about saying, hey, we've always applied to college. Maybe we don't need to do that anymore. And so I think there's a potentially a feature of some institutional inertia or kind of like slowness to change that might help explain part of that. However, for UW-Madison specifically, in many states, the state flagship or the most selective institution often doesn't participate in this program. And that's because they're admitting, less than 50% or even sometimes less than 25% of the people who ultimately apply. And so they utilize what's called a more holistic review process, where they are reading everyone's resumes, they're looking at everyone's statements, you know, letters of recommendation and things like that, in a way that kind of a simplified direct admission system doesn't lend itself very well to, of kind of just giving a number and kind of comparing that to a threshold. So I think it's a mix of institutional decision making and priorities, and also a mix of the type of student body that the campus is attracting and the features they use to evaluate them.
With some of these programs in other states have been going on for a number of cycles of the educational year, how does direct admission affect graduation and attendance rates?
Yeah. So I think unsurprisingly, right, if we think about college applications as a barrier for many students, you know, not even having a post-secondary option until you run what prior research has called this gauntlet of applying, you know, filling out letters, doing all this stuff. It's unsurprising when we remove that barrier that more people seem to go to college. And so Idaho was the very first state that adopted direct admissions, followed by South Dakota, Minnesota, Hawaii, so on and so forth. And we actually evaluated the program in Idaho in partnership with the state. And we found that in the year immediately after they adopted this program, they saw enrollment gains that were predominantly concentrated among their two-year and open access universities. So more people were enrolling in college. More people were enrolling in college from in-state as well.
Would other states see similar results? Could Wisconsin expect that, for instance?
Sure. I think they definitely should expect it. I think it would be unsurprising if that's what occurred. And you kind of referenced this like recent proliferation of these programs across the country. And I think so many states are hoping, right? I think at the end of the day too, it's kind of just a common sense solution, right? Why have we made this process so hard when we already have the data we need? Let's give some students and families some time back in their day to focus on where they should go to college rather than just completing this administrative task to apply.
I wonder, though, if direct admission could cause some students to feel maybe less committed to their top choice in a college that directly admits them. I mean, they haven't made any application effort per se to that college. And I guess it just, you know, I just wonder if matriculation at the end of the day could be somewhat problematic for some students committing.
Yeah, so it's a really great question. We've now done research in several states and worked directly with tens of thousands of students through the Common App platform, through some experiments we ran there. And we don't hear this or see this coming up from quantitative data or from qualitative data either. And the reason is this, the kind of student that you describe, who may feel, you know, less committed if they were directly admitted, they are already going to college. Their kind of future state is I'm going to enroll, and they're now making a decision about are they going to enroll here or are they going to enroll there. The students who are most likely to be impacted and positively supported by direct admissions are those who are maybe considering going to college at all. So they're making this no-go enrollment decision. And for those students, we don't see or have really a strong evidence to suggest that they are ultimately less committed to these institutions simply because they were directly admitted.
Do you find at all in your studies, is there a fear of rejection that could be a barrier as well?
Absolutely. There is a huge fear of rejection. We have over-sensationalized what some of my colleagues would call highly rejective colleges. If you go on YouTube and search college acceptance, you know, letter day or something, you can just watch student after student for hours getting rejected from some of the nation's most selective institutions. And the reality is only 6% of college students attend an institution with lower than a 25% acceptance rate. So we in our minds have changed and kind of developed an archetypical student as one who is attending a highly rejective or highly selective institution, and that's not the reality for most people. There was a recent survey of high school seniors that found that a majority of them reported that applying to college was among their most stressful academic experiences.
Wow.
So we have tons of administrative burden that we've placed on these students and families and counselors and principals, and coupled with that are students' beliefs that they're going to be rejected or that they're not even college material to begin with. And so what direct admissions is trying to do is combat each of those in a different way.
Taylor Odell with us, Assistant Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison, as we explore direct admissions programs and policies. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Jeff in Appleton is here. Jeff, hi.
Good morning. Taylor kind of hit on a point that I wanted to bring up. When you're doing this direct admission and just sending out to kids, you're going to bring in kids that aren't exactly committed to college. And when you do that, the graduation rate's low enough already. And when you're bringing in more kids that aren't exactly committed to it, there's a thing called student loan debt that's a big problem in our country right now. So when you bring in kids, they're bound to have a lower graduation rate. And so you're now going to have a lot of kids that have student loan debt that don't have a degree because of this program. Now, if student enrollment's going down, I think you might want to look at maybe just the cost of school. Maybe that has gotten too high. And maybe the universities want to address that.
Jeff, thank you so much for that. And Taylor, go ahead.
Yeah, great points, Jeff. So what I would ultimately say is that direct admissions doesn't require anyone to enroll in college. It doesn't compel them to take out student loan debt. What it's ultimately just saying is it's trying to simplify the process for students having the option to even enroll in college. Right now, they face a really steep uphill battle to just simply getting admitted, where they then make a decision, oh, am I committed? Do I enroll? Do I borrow to enroll in college? And direct admissions just kind of goes ahead and puts them at the top of that cliff or hill or whatever, so that they can make a more informed decision. Once they're admitted to an institution, they would have better information on financial aid, their cost of attendance, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're exactly right. And I don't think any policymaker or me, even as a researcher, wants to push students to do things or compel them to do things they don't want to do. What we're just trying to do, I think, is simplify this process for a lot of people. But you're exactly right that the cost of college is still a barrier for many people. And we shouldn't treat direct admissions as a way of addressing all of those challenges. We still need to focus on the cost of college and on financial aid.
So it sounds as if, you know, we are seeking a fix here for the application, the getting into the college part, but the financial piece, the affordability piece, is still yet to be worked on. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.